Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tekumel.
Okay, here we are in the Hall of Blue Illumination, scattered across the globe. Some of us in one continent, and one of us on another. Yet, through the extra planar sorceries, we summon conversation. With me today are James Malashevsky.
Hello.
And Victor Raymond.
Hey there.
Victor Raymond, you have news about Tekumel products in the pipeline. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I do. As you alluded to, I am currently in England. I'm in Hampshire currently and visiting friends and hopefully seeing some Tekumel fans this weekend. But just before I left on my family vacation, I had a chance to hold in my hands the proof copy of the print-on-demand version of Empire of the Pebble Throne. Ooh. Yes, the soft cover, which is really nice. I must admit that I had some trepidations on how the soft cover was going to turn out, and except for a couple of things which do indeed need to be fixed. The nice thing about it is that it's nice. It's nicely printed. It's tightly bound. It's a decent piece of work. And I think will be attractive. The color reproduction turned out pretty well. In fact, very well. And so I believe that we'll have something that will be instantly recognizable to any fans of Tekumel who've been around for a long time, but will also be something that could be put up on a shelf and might appeal to newcomers as well.
Is it likely that this product will be available at a large gaming convention that may or may not be located in the state of Indiana?
If you're talking about Gen Con and in July, it is quite possible that it will be available. I am even now in the process of getting the next proof copy done. And once that is approved, we can approve it for sale, and we'll probably order a bunch of copies and begin sending them around to people.
Excellent. We had a question online. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we had a question online about the status of the electronic version of Flame Song.
Good to know about that too. Yes, with Flame Song, we just received the art from Richard Hescox, who is the artist who did the cover for the original edition of Flame Song, the paperback copy. And so we're going to use that for the new edition of Flame Song, the print on demand and the ebook version of Flame Song. And we'll also offer that with the cover art by Giovanna. Giovanna's art is in the same style as what she had done previously for the Zatoa publishing editions. And so, we're looking forward to using both of them, actually.
Well, are there any other things that you would like to share?
Yes. Let's see here. We're going to be doing a number of other projects. The Jacolin Underworld at this point is moving along, as well as also we're beginning to put together a supplement for Empire of the Pebble Throne, which is going to be a compilation of the articles that appeared in The Dragon and The Strategic Review and Wargamer's Digest and Griffin that were related to the original Empire of the Petal Throne game. But since it's almost all completely source material, it'll be usable with any version of rules that you want to use for Tekkeno. So if you're playing Baithorn, it'll be great. If you're playing Fate of Tekkeno, it'll be great. And if you're playing Empire of the Petal Throne, it'll be great.
So I have a couple questions about these products. First of all,
sure.
Will they be print-on-demand and ebook or PDF?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the plan for most of this stuff. I mean, one of the problems that we've run into, and it's something that I've been at every, I would say periodically, I have checked in with friends of mine who were versed in the arcane elements of both layout and Adobe Acrobat, that scanning in the original material, if it were just in English, that would be relatively easy to do and we could get a clean scan. I have many friends who are doing that for different projects. But because Tekkenel products include words that are in Sulyani or other Tekkenelani languages, they have accent marks and diacritical marks, and scanning those can be interesting because they're difficult for OCR software to interpret. So one of the questions that we've been wrestling with all the way along is, what do we do with this old material? It is not just simply a matter of making it available. We can do that. That's fine. We do that already. But how do we make it available, and particularly for people who want to be able to have a searchable PDF, for example? And you know, it's not just simply a matter of getting the scan correct, although that's an issue. Another part of it is, okay, so say you're searching for a word like the city of Jakala, you know, Jakala as a word. Okay, so when you're putting in your search bar term, you know, typing it in, and you spell out J-A-K-A-L-L-A. Well, if you've got the accent marks, that means that what you really ought to have been putting in is J-A-K-A accent mark L-L-A, right? Jakala,
yeah.
Right?
That's frustrating
if you don't put that, yeah, if you don't put that in, you know, you just spell it without the accents, does Adobe Acrobat know to go and find all the accented versions, right? So this is an ongoing issue. We're going to continue working on it. It's not going to get solved overnight, but it is something that we want to make sure gets dealt with. And as I said, I have a number of people that I know who are expert in the ways of Acrobat who are giving us some advice on how to go about doing this. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of the initial PDFs have been image only, because we wanted to make sure it was available. And we know that some people would prefer it if it was searchable, but waiting for it to be available and searchable would mean that it would take much, much, much longer to do.
That makes total sense. It's adding the diacritical marks exceeds the capabilities of a lot of OCR stuff, or any OCR stuff that I'm aware of.
Like I said, there have been improvements in the technology over the past few years, and that's been very helpful. But at the same time, it turns into a time issue, because if nothing else, what you have to go back through and do is check every single page and make sure that you got it all right.
Yeah, got to hand edit the entire document.
Yep. And there are people who volunteered. Dave Lemire, for example, in New Zealand has volunteered to help out. And once I get back, hi Dave, once I get back from the UK, I am going to sit down and see if there's some particular chunk of material that I can send his way for the purposes of, and you know, if there's other people who'd like to volunteer to help out. But in all of this, it just takes time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that answers the first question quite nicely. The second question is, it's not a question, it's a request. My request is, please tell me more about this Jakalan underworld of which you speak.
Yes. So, yeah, here's the the other thing that's going on here. We have the Jakalan Underworld text complete. We have the scans, the image scans of the original key. There are people out there, I think, who would be interested in seeing what did the professor's actual key for the Jakalan Underworld look like. And then there's the maps themselves, and there's three maps total. One of them is 22 by 28 inches. Another one, and that's the first level. And then the other two are an 8.5 by 11 paper, graph paper. And these are all very detailed maps. And they represent what could best be described as the sort of good bits version of the Jakalan Underworld. This actually, it's interesting you should ask about that, because the Jakalan Underworld is a great example of what game Tecamel is like in comparison to real Tecamel. If it was real Tecamel, what would be on that 22 by 28 piece of graph paper would be scattered across. You know, if you were to try to map the Jakalan Underworld, it would probably take up, the scale that it's drawn at, which is 10 feet to every tenth of an inch. Okay? And none of this 4 or 5 squares to the inch business. 10 squares to the inch, and each one of those is 10 feet. You'd probably have to map it out across, you know, a very large room, right? If it were real Tecamel. But game Tecamel, and remember, this was drawn at a time when we didn't really have anything else to go by, game Tecamel has a bunch of things that Professor Barker put in essentially right next to one another. Imagine the ancient temple of Lumukla surrounded by a moat of fire that is actually very close to the vast labyrinthine underground temple to Lord Thiu, that in real Tecamel are separated by, you know, probably at least a mile of dusty, dangerous tunnels. But instead, on the drawn-out map, are within, 500 feet of each other.
It's like a week of Saturday night specials in one place.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, and in fact, on the first level, that 22 by 28 piece of graph paper, there's probably something on the order of about 24 different defined locations, each of which could be its own thing.
Okay. So this product, then, is a facsimile of the original materials.
That's correct. Okay. And in fact, one of the things that we would want to do with this is to probably alert people to the fact that, you know, this isn't exactly how Professor Barker ran it. I mean, he certainly had people that would have their characters go down into the underworld, you know, evade the tomb police and sneak downstairs.
But
But in so doing, what they would end up discovering is that Professor Barker might make, I know that over time, increasingly, he would do things in order to give a greater sense of distance between things. He would just have stuff in between, and that wouldn't necessarily be on the map. So.
Well, that's pretty cool. I look forward to seeing the stuff.
Yeah. We're talking with Jeff D. and with Alan Grohe from Black Blade Publishing on what would be the best way to go about reproducing that first level map. The current thought would be to at least look at the map of the city of Catalal, the gorgeous, beautiful map of the city of Catalal that was drawn by Alyssa Faden and is available through Pinterest, Jeff D's Pinterest site. Or not Pinterest, my list. DeviantArt. Why did I say Pinterest? DeviantArt.
Because they both have lots of pictures, that's why.
They both have, yeah, probably. But yes, go to Jeff D's DeviantArt site and you'll see this beautiful map of Catalan. And the thing about those maps is that they're nice in poster size. They're not 4x3, but they're definitely 3x2, and that gives us enough room because that's 36 inches by 24, and that would fit the entire first level plus a legend. And we could do another one with the second and third levels, as well as also any other supplementary material that would make sense to have on a map.
So one could observe that the Jakalan underworld would no longer be a legend upon making these materials available to the public.
Cricket.
I'll be here all week, folks. Thank you very much.
I think it would end up being a different kind of legend, because the one thing that it would do is this is definitely a Tekemel underworld, right? But it's also one of the few surviving examples of what dungeon design was like back in the earliest days of roleplaying. I mean, some of the only other examples of that we have are Dave Arneson's first fantasy campaign, and that doesn't include all of Blackmoor. That just includes some of Blackmoor Castle and Dungeon. We have Rob Kuntz's El Raja Key reproductions that are out there, but we don't have Greyhawk, by publishing the Jakalan Underworld, this is one of the earliest true mega dungeons that you can possibly find. I mean, I have to tell you that it's, even if you think that these things are right next to one another, you can look down that sort of omniscient view and you can see them being right next to one another. To player characters that are desperately trying to find their way out, they would never know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds fun. Another thing that I personally am looking forward to is volume 8 of the excellent traveling volume. How's that going,
Mr. More slowly than I had rather boldly anticipated long ago when I said it would be out imminently. It's going well. It's just that since that issue is the intention is to present material so that you can use it to kick off a new campaign for Empire of the Petal Throne set in and around Sokotis, I realize that's actually a little bit more than I guess I underestimated how much effort that actually was. I have tons of material to sort of include, but I want to tailor it in a way so that theoretically one could just pick up volume 8 and issue number 8 and just use it, and it would be sort of pretty user friendly for someone who'd never actually run a game of Empire of the Petal Throne. So I think maybe I'm feeling a little anxiety over how to do it just right. Eventually, I'll just say, it's good enough. But it's coming. It's just, it was more work than I anticipated. As I said, I was a little arrogant in assuming it would be done sooner.
Or maybe simply excited about it in the moment.
Well, I was excited, and I continue to be excited. Yes, I that's true. That's a much more charitable way of putting it. Okay, let's go. I was more excited. That sounds better.
Well, I'm sure that the people who appreciate the work you've done in the zine will be happy to receive something that meets your specifications rather than something that you simply released just because.
Oh, sure. And I don't think anyone's going to complain if I take another month or two more to get it right. At the same time, I've got several emails from people saying they're anxiously awaiting it, which probably, I appreciate it, but it probably has fed my worries about making sure that it's as good as it can be. So,
well, you can ask them in reply, how are their Tekemel campaigns going?
I do that sometimes, actually, and I sometimes hear things and sometimes I don't. So it's quite fascinating.
So you wanted to talk about something specific on the show today. What was that thing?
Well, what I was hoping that we could talk about, because it's quite fascinating to me, is that you know, if you look back on the publishing history of Tacamel as a setting, what's really interesting and what's obvious is that there's a lot of material that's been published over the years relating to military matters, specifically war game related military matters. There were the army lists. There's been, what, how many different, at least three different rule sets for miniatures wargaming, or has it been four? I can't remember.
Let's count them.
Well, there was Legions of the Petal Throne.
One.
Right.
There was Misum.
Two.
Right.
There was Kedar Dalekoi.
Three.
Kedar Dalekoi. Right.
And is that it?
There have been other sets of rules that have included Tekamel.
Right. I know there's the Hordes of the Things. There's a Hordes of the Things that has Tekamel material in it. Some edition of that, I believe, has that. Is that not correct?
Right.
It's a module of the game rather than the game itself. Yeah.
And then I think there was another set of rules published in one of the volumes of Seal of the Imperium.
There may have been. That wouldn't have been official.
No. Well, I know. But nonetheless, yeah. I'm just thinking. But there were three, as I say, there's at least three published and official rule sets relating to military, you know, wargaming on Tekamel. And it's pretty clear, or I shouldn't say that, it appears to me that Tekamel's history, I mean, as a setting, is tied up in a lot of interest in wargaming. I know Professor Barker mm-hmm. was interested in miniatures wargaming, I just found that fascinating. It's quite an interesting sort of a thing that not being a wargamer myself, but having sort of an eye on it, I was hoping, you know, we could sort of explore that a little bit if there's material to be explored.
Well, sure. I mean, one of the paths for advancement that is available in Empire of the Petal Throne, and certainly is suggested by other, you know, role-playing game rules written since then, has been the idea that once someone advances, you know, their character to, you know, some degree of ability, that they might decide as a warrior to become part of a legion. And in Professor Barker's original, you know, games, you know, after EPT came out, the idea was that they would not just become some, you know, Kuruthuni or Changadesha basically they wouldn't be just some grunt. They wouldn't be a trooper, but they would be like a Tirakamu or Hareksa or Kazi, you know, Tirakamu for a Semetal. That's a group of 20 soldiers, a Hareksa, who's commanding a Kareng, which is the group of 100 soldiers, or five Semetal Yao. And then the Kazi, who is the captain of a cohort. Usually, you know, like being a Hareksa or a Kazi, they would then, you know, take up command of their troops and then participate in whatever military activities seemed appropriate. So that was the original idea. In Professor Barker's original campaigns, you know, many characters went on to achieve positions of high rank and responsibility, you know, generals of the Empire. That was because a lot of the players themselves were wargamers and miniature gamers, and so they thought of this being a natural progression for the characters that start off as roustabouts in the Jakalan marketplace.
Well, I'd like to make an observation about the culture of gaming in the 70s, which I can't speak to directly, but I can speak to it in the early 80s. So when I got started gaming at Purdue in 83, there were a lot of wargamers there who were all in their mid to late 20s. So the fact that Tekamel has such a large wargaming component really comes as no surprise in the context of where the hobby came from in the first place. And this is spelled out really well in the Playing at the World book. Mm-hmm. But yep, I mean, I was so young.
John just the other day.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic book. But anyway, I had no understanding of wargaming at that age, but I did appreciate this whole other kind of thing that these older guys were doing. And it's interesting nowadays how Tecumseh is seen primarily as a role-playing setting. But it seems like at one point it had just as much of a miniatures thing going. But that has died off over time.
Not quite. I wouldn't say that. Howard Fielding is producing an excellent line of miniatures for Tecumseh, and it is primarily based on the military side of things, but there, you know, many of the figures that he's produced are perfectly suitable for role playing, and some of them, I believe, are some of the ones that he has are also specifically intended for role playing. So, but there are, you can indeed, if you want to build the Tsoyani and Yan Koryani army, you can do that.
I'm surprised no one's adapted one of the miniatures rules to a computer format.
That certainly would be something we'd be happy to look at if somebody came up with it.
I wish I had the
sounds good to me
chops, you know, for that. That's have many goals in my life, and who knows which of them I'll actually achieve. I don't know how much control I have over that, but being able to put together something fairly elementary that represented one of the Tecumseh wargaming rule sets would be super swell.
Well, and I think one of the things about this is that if you were going to want to add a military component to a role-playing campaign, it does kind of shift the focus of things in a couple of different ways. And we could talk about that some. I think there's some really kind of important things to think about before people do that.
Yeah, there are other role-playing games out there that are kind of military in nature, I'm guessing. I don't play any of them, but I think I've heard of them. One could definitely adapt some concepts from there and then use the source material as well.
Well, sure. I just think of this in terms of, yeah, they're going from the role-playing aspect of, okay, well, here's my character, you know, here are your characters. Let's, you know, go on adventure and do something. And it's got very much a very sort of set piece and understanding in D&D. But that changes when somebody says, well, my sixth-level warrior is going to take his money and get himself a commission in the Legion of Mordecai the Chieftain. No. That's probably not a good example. The Legion of the Inverted Hand from the Kurtz Hills, or the squadrons of Tlaneno the Steersman. And once they do that, then the campaign is going to change its focus. Is about the best way to put it.
Can you characterize how you envision that?
Focus changing? Well, yeah, I think the biggest thing about it is that rather than having some notional degree of freedom to decide where you're going, once a character achieves a military rank and starts, you know, building a military career, their fortunes and dispositions and stationing are at the whim of the Palace of Everglorious War. So this is a great way in a campaign, for example, if you want to go through and work out the initial and beginning, middle, and ending stages of the Tsoyani War with Yan Kor. Sure. That's great frame for a campaign, but it also means that, you know, the characters, including anybody who isn't a soldier, is probably going to be involved in, you know, trooping up to the Akalal Heights and fighting against the Yan Koryani or, heading through the Pass of Skulls and taking on the Sala, the Chiani, and the Minamaniani on that direction. So, if you don't want to run the war with Yonkor, or even the Soliani Civil War, the thing that ends up happening is that a cohort is the smallest unit that has independent disposition in the Soliani military. So that's 400 soldiers that are off going fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that they're going to establish camp, they're going to send out messengers, that they may engage in the form of warfare which is very ritualized in Tekkenel called the Kadamni battle. The Kadamni battle is one where cohorts go and fight other cohorts from other countries in a kind of less than all out war, but more than just peaceful competition. I mean, it is a battle, right? There are individual champion duels that are fought ahead of time. There are speeches. There are rituals to be enacted. There are military niceties to be observed. And then, and in fact, there's some reports to the Imperium that talk about all of this. So, I mean, and that could be a great frame for a campaign, but if you were thinking of your usual, bunch of player characters who were going to get together and, go track down this rumor or go merchanting off to Temissa, that may not fit with the orders from Besu or Avanthar saying that, greetings, Kazikoi, you and your cohort shall journey eastward to battle against the Saw of Yanni. You want to go one way, the Imperium decides you go another. And what is the correct and appropriate response? Yes, my word. No. I hear the word of the Emperor and I obey.
I think the narrative of Flamesong does a really good job of making something that's militarily themed that is also an adventuring party.
Yes. And in fact, actually, I think that's a great way to look at it, is that, it's not like you can't go role-playing. It's just that you've got a different frame within which it's going to operate. I mean, here's poor Trinish as a Hareksa. And, he's basically having to give orders on what's going to happen to the rest of his troops. And, let's go bury the dead. And, did you search all the casualties of the enemy? And what about sacrifices, in honor of our victory? And so on and so forth. And that can be a really great role-playing experience. And the thing is that at that scale, at the scale of the Kareng or the cohort, that's still manageable. You can still have things going on there. But when you become a Molkar or a Dritlan or a Kerdu of, and you're commanding an entire legion as a Kerdu, you're fighting a battle of bureaucracy more than anything else. Things become very abstracted. I think I talked about this before, that one of the things that happened was that Professor Barker was, he was very much into, let's see what I can do to challenge, the players. And when using the encounter tables off of something like Empire of the Pebble Throne, there's 80 Hutergu or 80, or 120 Sioux or, there's 100 bandits that you encounter. And he was sort of fully expecting the player characters would kind of step up to the plate and get involved in the battle for something like that. And particularly for those players who had military experience, they ended up, saying things like, there's bandits on the right flank. Detach cohorts 4, 5, and 6 and have them take care of that problem. Let's keep marching.
that's a good point. And to be fair, as you can attest, Scott, even with smaller numbers of troops, it does tend to change the calculus of what the characters themselves get personally involved in. Even if you're just traveling about the countryside with a fairly small force of, you know, like a Sumetal of 20 men or whatever, it does mean that, you know, you can send those people off, those soldiers off, to deal with immediate threats, and the characters themselves don't personally become involved in them, which is fine. And it's a different kind of a campaign structure, but it does get away from that kind of, you know, personal interaction with these sort of these threats and dangers that you wouldn't have when you just have, you know, a smaller group of people and perhaps a couple of, you know, well trusted you know, servants or whatever. Yes, exactly.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, I mean, what Victor says is, I think, is very well taken. I mean, when you start getting involved in military sort of things, and the comment about, you know, bureaucracy and so forth, and the higher up you go, it does sort of change the complexion of the way that individual sort of activities will go. In terms of, you know, the personal involvement of player characters, you know, what they will be doing will necessarily change the more underlings they have beneath them. And it will affect things considerably. I mean, I know that that's sort of the nature of the way campaigns evolve over time and how they were originally intended, how Professor Barker expected that things would happen, which is one of the reasons why, truth be told, I would love one day to hear some tales from people who were actually directly involved in those campaigns, that campaign early on. What would it be like to be a general, you know, a great general of the empire, or a governor of some city, or, you know, some bureaucrat within the Imperium? What it's like to run a campaign, you know, to play in a circumstance like that, where the character has a great deal of authority and responsibility that goes with it, and how, you know, what is done in a case like that to challenge the player, to make it fun and engaging in a way that it doesn't immediately seem obvious, you know, to people. And I'm sure Professor Barker managed to do that. I mean, I think that was his, you know, he was good at that sort of thing.
Yeah, he's very good at that. I think that would be something that would be very illuminating, particularly if we get some of the players who themselves were indeed the commanding officers of legions, if only for the fact that, you know, being in the hot seat for something like that is different than being part of the priestly or, you know, sorceress retinue of the Legion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was usually the way that player characters who were not in the military, or who had only, you know, who were essentially a supporting role, would go along, is that they were part of essentially the administrative administrative train to the Legion, or maybe possibly part of the military sorcery unit, although there was only a few characters that ever did that. And then the reason for that is that the military sorcerer option was one of those things that was more an offstage element of game tech and all than it was something that player characters were encouraged to be a part of.
Yeah. And to sort of tie this back into what brought this topic up in the first place, I mean, if you know, you may not know, mm-hmm. but where... player characters were generals and other sort of commanding officers within a legion, their activities, were they played out as a result of like miniatures battles? I mean, were the rules so they were used, so these were actually, you know, incorporated into the campaign then?
Yeah, and truth be told, not every single battle was gained out, nor were the results of the battle always exactly translated into what Professor Barker had going on. I mean, one of the sayings around Professor Barker's gaming table was that the dice never lie. But the problem with this is that it is a rather significant gamble to stage a miniatures battle and then say, well, the outcome of this battle is going to affect what happens in the world. You know, yeah. When the amount of things that could go on were, you know, less determinate you know, they were more indeterminate than they would be for a role-playing game group. You know, the amount of trouble that a role-playing game group is not necessarily all that much. I mean, I say that as somebody who ended up doing a lot of kind of cosmic level adventures.
But even so,
I mean, still on a smaller scale than a battle that involves, you know, tens of thousands of troops.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the sort of thing that I guess I'm intrigued by as well, is sort of, you know, how these things were incorporated into the campaign and how that was actually done. Which is why, as I say, it might be something in the future to learn more about this.
Well, you know, from what I recall of it, because I started gaming at about the time that some of that began to we began to transition away from the more military military aspects of gaming. When the thing that I can tell you is that what Phil would do is that, you know, miniatures battles would be staged, and then Phil would engage in a kind of synthesis of the material to come up with some sort of satisfactory integration into the timeline that he had established.
That he did not accept the results of what happened?
What would end up happening is, well, okay, for the amount of battle, say, for example, battle turned out in a way that he didn't necessarily completely agree with. What he might very well have done is said something along the lines of, like, well, yes, the battle ended this way, but then this other thing happened, essentially off stage, which, you know, may have affected the outcome in some way. I mean, the basic way that he ended up doing it was to take what ended up happening on the gaming table as being, well, I guess that's what happened. And then by integrating it into the rest of the game, he would say, well, what other things could affect that? And in that sense, this is I'm retconning here. Okay, I want to be very clear. I'm retconning here. But it seemed to me pretty clearly that what Phil was doing was he was taking the results of different miniatures battles and saying, yes, that's what happened, but there were these other things, and he would get closer to the result that he was hoping for.
I think that's what we do as GMs as well, not necessarily with miniatures battles, but when players come up with some things that are just great ideas that may not have occurred to you, at least I try and incorporate them into what I already have going on, and it seems like a similar way of doing it. It's like if you draw an analogy between the players and whatever's happening on a miniatures battle, sure, that's what happened, but only the GM or the creator of the world knows the deep backstory of what's actually happening. So it doesn't seem like it's too much of a stretch to take whatever events occur and then fit them into a larger framework.
I think that's a great way to proceed. I mean, is to sort of always keep the grand strategic frame in mind, knowing that you can see how things work out in the immediate tactical moment. I recall from letters that Professor Barker talked about how they gamed out the Battle of the Temple of Chanis, the battle account that appears in the Dragon Number 4.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They gamed it out three different times. Okay, I think they were all using Massoom, the rules that were written by Gary Rudolph and Craig Smith. And, two cases that Soliani won, and one case that Magliani won. They're like, oh, okay. You know, and in so doing, it's kind of like, all right, well, you know, out of those three, you know, gained opportunities, well, you know, Professor Barker pulled together a synthesis of that in order to write the battle account and give a sense of how things turned out.
Because I have to admit, from my own point of view, I rather like the idea. I mean, that's why I wish it were easier to integrate these things into a role-playing campaign. I like the idea of, you know, gaming out battles and then sort of like, oh, well, that's what happened. And then using that as a sort of catalyst for advancing the history of a campaign world and seeing, you know, well, there was this battle that took place and player characters were involved and they screwed up. So as a result, these consequences occur. Or ultimately, you know, they managed to, you know, rally the forces and turn back the invaders. And then there were these different consequences. I really very, very much like the idea of leaving those things up to the combination of player choice and chance, because frankly, a lot of times I don't have a strong sense of, well, how things should unfold. I am different, I suppose, from Professor Barker in that I don't have a grand narrative or expectation of how history is going to unfold. I don't know, and I like having, they're a good impetus for my imagination and being able to say, okay, well, this is what happened as a result of, you know, the choice and the dice rolls. And then, okay, let's see where that goes and then continue on from there. So I really do wish there were an easy way to do that kind of a thing.
Volume 9, excellent traveling volume. You heard it first from me.
You're going to write it then, are you, Scott?
Well, I don't know. Not yet.
You don't know. Well, okay.
Professor Barker, we've got top men working on that. Top men. Yeah. Actually, in some ways, this sort of suggests that one, you know, a project that someone might undertake at some point, not to take anything away from the excellent work that Howard has been doing, but, you know, maybe there's room for something like a System 7 Napoleonics for Tekkenel. And System 7 Napoleonics was essentially trying to bridge the line separating hex and chit board gaming from miniatures gaming. That is to say, to provide printed you know, chits that could be used in much the same fashion as miniatures, but to try to come up with a way in which you could actually game out some of these things without having to spend lots of time and money on recreating armies three-dimensionally.
Wait, correct me if I'm mistaken, because my war games history is poor. Is that the thing that GW did?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I remember it. I never owned it or played it, but I do recall its existence. And that's what that was. That was the intention of that.
Yeah, that was the whole idea. You know, you could essentially buy your Soliani army, you could buy your Yankoriani army. That would essentially be an awful lot of printed die-cut counters, and then have a set of rules that you could use to game out battles that way. That could be kind of interesting, actually.
I came to that same conclusion when I was fantasizing about what a computer game would look like for Tekkenel Wargaming.
Sure.
And you don't need to have fancy graphics or 3D whatever. You can just have a hex map with a representation of the formation on it.
Yeah, now, I'd like to sort of segue from this discussion to some military aspects of Tekkenel that don't get talked about very much. Okay?
Sure.
That could provide the basis for some interesting campaigns. And just to give you a sense of this, there's about four different contexts that I could point at for adding a military component to your game that doesn't automatically turn into, oh my gosh, what war do we go fight? Okay. And that is to remember that there are a whole bunch of other military and quasi-military units that exist that are often, in fact, form the basis for the reserves of the actual military legions, okay? And these include, but are not immediately limited to, city and town guards, Sock Bay road guards, temple guards, and various other landborne military units, like, for example, Marines of one sort or another. Okay. And so, for example, one way to run a military kind of campaign is, oh, you want to become a soldier? Well, okay. The city guard is looking for likely up and coming persons who could then help ensure that the city is safe, that, you know, patrols are undertaken and drills are maintained in order to keep the guard as a viable police as well as military unit. Ditto the same thing for Sauk Bay Road Guards. All right, well, you're responsible from this tower to this tower, you know, and you got to make sure that that area is garrisoned properly. And, oh, by the way, there's this village nearby. Or maybe two. Or a town, you know.
Have you guys read The Black Company? Glenn Cook?
Oh, sure.
I did a long time ago, yes. Yeah,
this is reminding me of that. Small-scale military paramilitary role-playing setting.
Yeah. And Temple Guard, the same way. Particularly if it's the temples of the Mokar or Karakhan. You know, the temple guards for those are, you know, you're a temple guard, and oh, by the way, you're the, you know, 29th reserve cohort for the Legion of the Lord of Red Devastation. You know, should we go to war? You know, we'll call you up.
Don't call us. We'll call you.
Yeah. But, I mean, I guess in a sense, you know, there's this tendency to sort of think, oh, well, then I'm going to become part of the named and numbered Legion. I'm going to go off and do these things. It's like, no, you could be. You know, there's any number of ways to include that military element. You could be part of the governor's guard for a provincial governor. You know, governor has got, you know, say 100 or 200 troops that he has, you know, that are specifically in addition to all the ones that are out there. And those, again, form the basis for reserves in the greater military.
Don't tell James, or we'll make him run yet another Tekkamil campaign.
Well, one day that may happen anyway. So,
but I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, for James, particularly you're running a long-standing campaign. There's certainly the option for people to explore those possibilities.
Oh, definitely, and some related possibilities are already in the midst of being explored in the Sokatis campaign. So I ask these questions not purely as academic ones, but partially because I'm curious to get some ideas and inspiration about how to proceed once the characters reach a point where they would assume positions of authority and responsibility on behalf of the Imperium, and how to go about doing that in a way that's manageable and fun, and striking the balance between those things is difficult sometimes, at least I find so.
Well, and yet another time-honored traditional role for the military is every legion has not only its active cohorts, the ones in training, but it also has its legion headquarters, where it is based out of, and where does it maintain its barracks. And out of those barracks, there are officers who, I'm sure, you know, there are Tirakamus and Kazis and Molkars whose job it is, they're not the lead officers of the Legion, but they are essentially staff officers whose job it is to go out and find the likely recruits, you know, to put the Emperor's Kytar into a cup of wine and to pass it off to some country bumpkin who will be then...
Do they do that in Solyana? Yeah, I got the impression that they did do that. But
I wouldn't say necessarily it was quite that direct, that sort of, you know, I've taken the king's shilling. But it certainly is the case that what they would do is that, you know, they would go out, you know, that officers of the Legion would be directed to go and to recruit from, you know, the likely clans that would provide appropriate appropriate Legion members, you know,
yes.
Enlistees.
I mean, again, this may be a false perception on my part, but I've always sort of had the notion in my mind, anyway, that the Solyani legions are a bit more professional, you know, than that. I mean, it's not the kind of thing where you generally tend to impress people into service in the legion.
No, right? No. Don't. I'm not thinking so much of the press gang as it is, you know, come on, you know, do you see yourself, you know, plowing
sure.
arrows? For the rest of your life, or would you like to take the Emperor's coin and go see the world, you know?
Absolutely.
That sort of thing is the sort of thing that we, you know,
right.
Certainly new legions or legions that need to have their numbers replenished in a hurry might use those kinds of tactics.
Yeah. And yeah, maybe that's another way to start a military campaign. Yes, it is by the direct order of the emperor, you know, all praise of the gods be upon him, that the previously somnolent legion, the X number of medium infantry, be reestablished and brought back to life. And, you know, and so guess what? Your job. You are part of the officers of this new legion and have to get everything up.
I tried that tactic. It started to work for a little while.
Yeah.
It may again at some point.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, actually, if you look at the army list, what you'll see is a bunch of legions that directly were the result of that kind of activity.
Sure, and there's lots of gaps in the numbering system. And because I get the impression that, you know, once a number is assigned to a legion, it's rarely reassigned to a new legion, even if the previous holder of that number sort of goes defunct, that you can, it gives plenty of scope for referees and players to sort of, you know, recreate or insert their own legions as they wish.
Sure. The Legion of Searing Flame, the Soliani Heavy Infantry Legion, that was reestablished by order of the Emperor under the direction of the Temple of Umukla. That was specifically part of the mustering for the war with Yon Kor, but it also provided Kadarsha Hitlekamu, that's Craig Smith's character, with a command. You know, yes, you know, most notable warrior and former city governor, you will be given command of the heavy infantry legion. Go forth and be mighty.
Excellent.
You know. So yeah, these are all different ways in which you could include the military in a campaign. And truth be told, I think it's also important to remember that there's kind of a status hierarchy here going on, that village guards are the least status in the military, city guards, Sakbe road guards, temple guards kind of come next. And then eventually you get to the actual military units themselves. And there's a whole bunch of exploration that can be done along the way for a player character to go from, they don't have to make the automatic jump to being, you know, you're in charge of a cohort or a legion. They can go and do things for a while, get some military ability, and then translate that into something bigger later on.
I want to play in all of these games.
Of course, as do we all.
And I want to play in the game where we're all tomb guards. And we have to decide.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Whether we're going to go steal stuff or whether we're going to keep people from stealing stuff or both.
But that's another one, particularly for a party of characters who are more aligned with the Dark Trinity. I mean, yeah, you know, it's kind of like, hoi, Harexa, you're in charge of the tomb guards for, you know, the night shift for the next month. You know, what are your dispositions, right? You know, the tomb police, how are you going to make sure that those adventurers are driven out of, you know, the sacred, you know, precincts of the honored and sacred dead?
Unless, of course, they can provide suitable, you know, gifts and promises to be discreet in their actions, in which case you may be willing to look the other way.
Well, if there are persons who are engaging in activities that are not besmirching the...
Well, of course. Certainly. Well, that's exactly what they said when they handed you that bag of Kytar.
And who am I to question their veracity under those circumstances?
Indeed, it would be ignoble to do so.
Exactly.
I questioned the bag of Kytars, but it did not respond.
Exactly. Yeah.
But no, that would be another excellent campaign frame, I think, or at least just sort of a segment of a larger campaign where, you know, military sort of things you're dealing with soldiers who are tasked with keeping an eye on the city of the dead.
Exactly. So. Yeah, the military aspects of Tekumel are broad and varied. We barely touched on them. You know, we haven't talked about Seaborne forces we haven't talked about, what to do in terms of, the smaller states, and what about foreigners serving in different places? What about all those Shen and Ahoya and other auxiliary units? Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that we could talk about here. But as far as the player characters themselves are concerned, lots of options. Don't just simply have to, join the military and go straight to war.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find TechML Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of TechML.